I'm interested in exploring possibilities and really developing projects almost as a sense of prototypes for new models of how we could live, how we could work, and how we can maybe reinterpret places, spaces, and ultimately the lives of people and give stages for an exciting way to live.
We sit down with German architect Ole Schieren to talk about his latest Sky Forest project in Ho Chi Minh City and the architect's fascination with greenery, density, and building business in Southeast Asia. This is Section D, Monocle 24's weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Also today...
We're not trying to feed the monster, which is the syndrome that you get where architects take on more and more people because they want a big office, and then they have to take on more and more work, regardless of whether that's the right work or not.
We visit the studios of Jamie Fobert, a Canadian well known for his work at leading art institutions such as the new Tate St. Ives extension, and get his tips for running a successful practice. And
it was really important to us to have like a really decent geographic spread and not make the book too Euro-focused. That was a really exciting task, you know, making sure that we had a good coverage through Africa, for example.
We speak to the editor of a new travel guide devoted entirely to contemporary buildings, who shares her favourites of the bunch. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. German-born architect Ole Schieren made a name for himself for designing a string of large-scale projects throughout Asia, including the Mahanakhon Tower in Bangkok and the charming jumble of boxes that comprise the Interlace Building in Singapore. Never one to rest on his laurels, the talented Beijing-based architect has embarked on an upcoming skyscraper project in Vietnam dubbed the Sky Forest. Monocle's ever-intrepid design editor Nolan Giles sat down with Schieren to mull over the benefits and pitfalls of working in the fast-changing and high-octane Asian market, plus how the fated German architect consolidated his enviable reputation in the region.
My experience with Asia started some 25 years ago, when I traveled to China for the first time and saw a part of the world that back then was still nowhere near where it is today. Back then, basically, almost nobody spoke about China. It wasn't quite on the map yet. But as you came to the country, you could feel this incredible energy of something that was going somewhere. From that moment onwards, I was very interested in Asia and I kept going back.
And in terms of, you know, Southeast Asia, even now, when you visit a region like that, you can still feel the energy. But at what point did you kind of realize that there was potential to really do architectural work on a grand scale there?
Maybe some 10 years later, the entire region, in a way, fueled by China's emergence also, and China's really enormous scale of movement, of development, of change that started to take place. The economy grew, and I think that affected the whole region.
And were there still difficulties, someone that was trained not in the region to come over there and work? What were your first difficulties, I guess, getting into work there?
I think always when you enter a new context, you have to be willing to leave parts of yourself behind in order to find and understand the new place and find yourself in the new place. And I was always interested in doing that, not to simply impose ideas of how we had learned to do things, but really to try to understand how things actually worked in those places, and then how to see how we could maybe challenge those conditions in a positive and productive way, and how we could develop somehow a synergetic position.
I'd love to hear you unpack that through one of your projects, perhaps the Interlace, because, you know, I've seen that building and you kind of come past it along the road and it's not necessarily jumping out and screaming at you, but then when you take a closer look, there is quite a complex structure going on there, and something that's very interesting, and something also that's very much woven into, I guess, almost like jungle-like surrounds. How did you kind of find that balance, like you say, of doing something that's sensitive to the context of the place, but also put yourself into the building as well?
The Interlace is a fairly large-scale residential development with 1,040 units, so really It's about building a big community. And I was interested in how we could question the status quo of the residential tower, which is really dominant in that part of the world. The brief suggested that we would build 12 towers of 24 floors, because that was the prescribed height limit on the site. And I wondered if a project of that scale could not start to address very different questions and qualities about maybe how we want to live. So what I did was, if you like, topple the towers, turn the vertical into the horizontal, created a series of 31 horizontal building blocks that then I stacked up on a hexagonal grid to form huge courtyards. And these courtyards with a very lush tropical landscape, big gardens around which the building would unfold.
This is in a city where, like you say, it's just skyscraper after skyscraper. How difficult was it to kind of get that past the developer and allow a country like Singapore and a developer in a country like Singapore to work with your vision for doing something that's quite different there?
I think at first, when I presented the project, it was probably a big shock because it looked so different that I think most people assumed it couldn't work. I had to prove with very careful steps that we had constructed this building in a way not only as a vision for a particular way to live and maybe a different quality of how to live, but also as a financial mechanism that would function in that particular context.
And are there advantages to working in that market that allow you to be a bit more adventurous when you're working with these developers? I'm guessing, you know, it's probably cheaper to construct things in a place like Singapore, but what are the advantages to kind of being able to do these beautiful sculptural works in a place like Southeast Asia?
I think Southeast Asia has an incredible energy, really. But I believe that this part of the world is really very specifically dedicated and focused on the question of the future. They have to reinvent themselves with the speed of development, the speed of urbanization that is taking place, where previous models simply cannot cater for the actual realities and challenges at hand.
Let's move on to the project Empire City in Ho Chi Minh City. You know, Singapore and Vietnam are very different places, but what Vietnam might lack in money and, you know, average wealth and things like that, they probably make up for in a way in energy and optimism. It's a very young country, but yet your project, it still looking at it on paper, it seems very, very ambitious. You know, it's the biggest tower in the city by quite a long way, and even the existing tower, which is the largest one, that's kind of stands out quite significantly in the context of the city. How did this come about, first of all?
The project is a joint venture led by Vietnamese developers together with Hong Kong and Singaporean investors. It, in that sense, also really represents the culmination of energy in the region that is now very much focusing on Vietnam as one of the real hotspots of activity. I was very interested in thinking about how a place like this and a country or a city like this could, through this potential of architecture, maybe also think about defining its future identity and its identity in a linkage looking forward, but also looking backwards to its past, to the great qualities that the country actually has and the countryside of that country actually has.
And how have you achieved that? I mean, we can't see the renders now, but I'd love to kind of hear your explanation of the aesthetics of the building, because there is almost this garden or maybe even a mini jungle halfway up the tower. How does it look and feel? What is it going to be like for the people that are going to be there enjoying it when it actually finishes?
We called the project the Sky Forest because we're actually on the ground. The podium is a big landscape mound of multiple terraces and gardens that unfold a very three-dimensional and oasis-like quality of nature and human activity on the ground. Then we've taken part of that nature and activity and basically elevated it, lifted it up into the sky of a 333-meter-tall tower to, in a way, bring the sky and the earth closer together, or a piece of the earth into the sky.
It's very pioneering in a way for a city like Ho Chi Minh City. And thinking about your work, I guess, with the CCTV HQ in China and then your tower in Bangkok, all of these projects have kind of pushed the boundaries, quite far from what was there before. Is that a characteristic of your work? Is that something you enjoy doing in these places?
Yeah, I'm interested in exploring possibilities and really developing projects almost as a sense of prototypes for new models of how we could live, how we could work, and how we can maybe reinterpret places, spaces, and ultimately the lives of people and give stages for an exciting way to live.
And I'd love to hear about what you think of Vietnam right now as a place for design and architecture, because there's some very good work coming out of even Ho Chi Minh City, lots of good architects doing work beyond Vietnam, even moving into Southeast Asia and beyond. And like you said before, it's a very young place, very entrepreneurial. What's the energy like among the designers there, and how does that, I guess, how do you feel that?
Yeah, I think there's a real emerging consciousness of the place itself and of all the things that maybe it can also contribute not only to its own redefinition and growth, but really to the region as a whole.
And before, when you were talking about the Interlace, you were saying how it was questioning the notion of a residential tower and you were dispersing it a little bit. But now you've kind of gone back to the tower mold in Ho Chi Minh City. How are you really trying to push yourself as an architect with this project?
Well, I think the tower, I'm very interested in towers because they are a reality. They're in a way an almost unquestionable reality. But what we can question is the very nature in which the tower functions. And I'm interested in breaking open the mute shaft of the tower and, in a way, giving scale to a building. Because as buildings become so large, it becomes very hard to actually understand how large they really are. It becomes very hard to understand who is actually in them. Normally, human activity completely disappears in buildings of that scale. And I'm quite interested in how we can open up these buildings and reveal human activity as what it all is about. And in a way, I think, create an exciting place for human activity, but also use that as an image to broadcast back to the city and thereby connect the public domain and these buildings.
And that's kind of what's been successful with your buildings, particularly the tower in Bangkok, is really creating these public forums. But there's also a very strong sculptural element to your work. You know, that's this dissolving tower almost in the middle of the city. How do you interpret the culture and the context of a place when you're thinking about the actual aesthetic of the building, the sculptural elements? Does that come into play, or is it about yourself and your own ideas?
Well, I think all the work I'm doing is extremely site and location specific. I like to spend a lot of time in the places that I design to really absorb also the psychology of a place. And I believe it's quite important to have a sense for the psychology of people, of how they live, of what they relate to, and then to work with that. But of course also to challenge that, but to find very precise ways in which you can give space to what is there, but also how you can then push that to another level.
Beijing-based architect Ole Sheeran there, speaking to Monocle's one and only design editor, Nolan Giles. This week, our aside comes courtesy of the Monocle Winter Weekly, a newspaper produced by the editorial team here at Midori House each week in December. It's available now from the world's better newsstands and throughout December. First up, Monocle's contributing editor Andrew Muller visited the Czech Republic's UK embassy in West London for a few cues on the 1970-built Brutalist gem, as well as how it's weathered the political tumult of the past few decades in such a fine style. We also visit our Building Centrum Holzbau Zurich, a pedagogical play and a bit of a mouthful of a carpentry school in Switzerland that's going against the grain to furnish its students with a love of wood. On the subject of school, we also visit the Nantes École des Beaux-Arts building in Brittany. Our senior correspondent Sophie Grove sailed through the new premises in a former shipbuilding factory to meet the team tasked with keeping the local design scene afloat. Issue 2 of the Monocle Winter Weekly newspaper is available now. The Metaphorical Section D mailbag is, of course, always open to queries and suggestions. Do get in touch by emailing our producer, Ben Ryland. He's at br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Do stay tuned. From the world's biggest firms to local studios doing lively work, we're always keen to take a peek behind the closed door of architecture and design practices for a few top tips on running your own shop. Monocle's Daphne Karnesis visited the studio of Jamie Faubert, a Canadian architect who's made London his home and the base of a thriving practice for the past 21 years. From residential projects in central London to a farmhouse in rural Ireland to shops for the likes of Givenchy and Versace, here's what he told Daphne.
We don't start until 9:30, so it's not exactly a panicky in the morning. And I generally tend to want to answer my emails and to do anything written that I have to get done, anything financial, anything dull, I try and do in the morning. I get better at design the later it gets in the day. I think this is a terrible hangover from being an architecture student and working through the night. I tend to do my best work after it's dark, like a vampire. And then often there's people in the office who have taken work to a certain point, and we sit down and we go through the project. I sketch. On the whole, I don't draw on computer. I'm too much of a liability on the computer. But I draw by hand and I sketch. And we always have a few year out students here who are between their part one and their part two. And they're building models, making material studies, and we try and make a lot of physical experimentation in the office. So I sketch, and then often I'll just take a project at a point where I'm not quite sure and sit. I sit at the very back. My desk is in the middle of everybody else's. I don't have an office. I come into the meeting room if I need to meet with someone, but I prefer to be in the middle of everyone. In a way, everyone hears everything that's going on, and that way we act much more as a team.
How big is your team?
20 altogether, yeah. And it's been 20 for a few years, and it's a kind of number I quite like. It means we can take on a couple of arts projects, a couple of houses, we can do some retail, we can do a mix of things, and yet we're not trying to sort of feed the monster, which is the syndrome that you get when architects take on more and more people because they want a big office, and then they have to take on more and more work, regardless of whether that's the right work or not, and they start to be caught. And I think it's really important to keep, I'm quite happy to keep the office at the right scale, at a scale where we can do our projects really well and we can enjoy them, and where I can work personally on every project.
We actually interviewed John Pawson, and he was talking about how photography for him is a big source of inspiration, how he uses it to capture certain moments that have inspired him. What would you say for you is the equivalent, the way that you draw and capture your inspiration for your projects?
Well, I think for a very long time, since being a child, I think the most important experiences for me are about going to galleries and seeing the work of artists, particularly sculptors, in their clarity of making form and their sensibility of materiality. And you can't see enough good sculpture to understand how an intuitive process, as opposed to a kind of rationalized dialogue about, or kind of theory. But the way artists work with the material, they spend a lot of time working with the material to the point that they know what that material does and what it doesn't do, what it looks best at, and by working and reworking. So some of the artists who are painters who I admire the most are, for instance, Morandi, who painted the same set of objects on a table from 1930 to 1968, over and over. I mean, it's the nature of the way he saw them changed radically, but he focused and he kept himself in a very small sphere of space. And the Danish painter Hammershøi, who painted the interior of his own apartment over and over and over again. And then somehow, because there's repetition, there's a sense of being able to capture something which is very hard to see the first or second time. And so for Hammershøi, he actually was able to start to paint the atmosphere of the room, the time of day, the tone of the room. And so I think in this work and in all the work that we do, we draw very much on the work of sculptors.
you worked for David Chipperfield for some time, and I can see here what one of my questions to you is going to be. I believe David Chipperfield works quite a lot with physical models. Is that something, is that a method of working that you've carried with you?
Absolutely. I did my degree at the University of Toronto, and I came to London. I had an English grandmother, so I could come to Britain. And I thought I'd come for a year or two. And I was very fortunate that I started working in David's office when there were five people in the office. So it was David and five of us. And so it was. And I stayed for 9 years and worked on a whole number of projects and competitions. And for me, it was the ultimate master's and PhD in architecture, spending 9 years in David's practice. And what I learned from David is impossible to even list, because it's everything that I'd learned. I went to architecture school for 5 years and I worked in David's office for nine. So my education for me was David's office, and it couldn't have been a better education. And there are many things that I brought from that, and working in physical models is absolutely one of them. And we do it repeatedly. I mean, we have to throw away a vast majority of them, but we produce models after models. And there are things that you realize with a physical model that you can just never realize on a computer and a 3D rendering. The simple fact is, if you can build it at 1 to 20, you can most likely build it on site. And if you can't make a model of it, then there's probably a problem with it. Yeah, so I've taken a lot. And David's sense of working with daylight, which was really important in St. Ives, and equally important here, is something that I've really always carried with me. It's a set of knowledge which is very hard to just obtain quickly. And I think young architects are often miss out on some really great opportunities by wanting things too quickly and by going too quickly and not really learning these things by repetition. Buildings we're in are called the Rochelle School, and they were built as the primary and secondary school for the new council estate. And the room we're in, which is like a Cambridge dining hall, it was built as the primary school. And there had been partial partitions all down the room with bleachers, and classes of students sat on the bleachers, and the teachers taught in a row, and the headmaster or the headmistress could watch all the teachers simultaneously. It must have been quite extraordinary.
That was architect Jamie Faubert speaking to Monocle's Daphne Karnezes from his studio in London's Shoreditch. And finally on today's show, we explore the curious link between architecture and travel. Sensing a growing demand from savvy and design-minded globetrotters with an appetite to learn more about contemporary buildings in the countries that they visit, a new guide entitled Destination Architecture, published by Fiden, is devoted to just that. Monocle's Daphne Karnezes started by asking the book's editor, Belle Place, what landmark buildings betray about a city's psyche.
We were thinking about this a lot when we were sourcing images of the buildings in the book, because we were really drawn to the buildings that sort of had that element of spectacle to them. This idea that people will travel now to see a building because they want, say, like a captivating image for their Instagram or something. So you're seeing a rise in architecture as spectacle. And then there's buildings included in the book, like in Bilbao, the Guggenheim, which, you know, totally transformed that whole city from a cultural wasteland into this site that people would go to see Gehry's building there, just as much as they would the art inside it. We found a lot of quite spectacular buildings in small, random towns around the world that had these incredibly heavy-hitting buildings in them that also related to the scenery there as well, using local materials or buildings with spiked roofs that reference the mountains that surrounded a particular town.
Anyone who's ever worked on a book knows that often the things that you leave out are perhaps just as telling as what you include. How did you go about choosing what made the final draft and what didn't make it?
I guess it was a collaborative approach. Often maybe there were some arguments about what should stay and what should go, but that was the fun part. It was really important to us to have a really decent geographic spread and not make the book too like Euro-focused. that was a really exciting task, you know, making sure that we had a good coverage through Africa, for example. We didn't want to build the list by numbers. Like, we didn't want to just hit a certain target. Each building needed to be compelling and legitimate place in the book. The bulk of the book goes to Europe, and then after that, probably North America. Yeah, it was a collaborative effort between all the Fiden architectural editors, starting with a very, very long list and then slowly whittling that down.
And are there any overlooked gems that you came across in your research that perhaps you weren't aware of beforehand?
Yeah, that was a really exciting part of the project. We really wanted to put in a lot of young, emerging firms that most people might not have heard of. One of my favourite buildings is a building by 6A, which is a London-based firm. And it's a college building in Cambridge. It's quite a modest building on first appearance, but if you look more closely, and it sort of has this masonry cladding that references all the 1960s college buildings that are around it, but at the same time, it's very modern. Putting in one of Francis Carré's buildings that he did in Mali, and again, it's quite a small building. It's a visitor centre, but it has like really striking features about it, like a cantilevered roof so the community can have shade. We found a lot of smaller, more quiet projects that are just as legitimate as, say, one of Zaha Hadid's more spectacular projects.
And how did it work logistics-wise? Did you travel a lot yourself?
It did inspire me to want to go to a lot of places, and I did start creating a list of buildings that I'd love to go and visit. But we did a lot of research we took from other Fiden titles that we'd done, and then looking at buildings that had piqued interest because they'd won an award or no travel, though.
The book is, I'd say, an intersection between travel and architecture. Do you think that tourism based on architecture is a growing field, a growing sector, and why do you think that is?
Yeah, I absolutely think it is. I touched on this before, this idea of architecture as kind of spectacle or as something that's as interesting to people now as going to see a particular gallery or even a store. I think people now put buildings on their list when they travel.
On their travel itinerary.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Like going to see the Guggenheim in Bilbao, that would be the reason to travel there.
Yeah. And perhaps the architectural design section of traditional travel guides isn't big enough for them, or they just want inspiration on where their next trip will be based on what contemporary architecture there is available.
100%. And I think that's an interesting point. Travel guides normally just allocate a small chapter to architecture, and people are seeking out more now. And I think everyone's, you know, if you're going to Paris, you'll see the Eiffel Tower as you move around the city. We found that people are now wanting to travel somewhere a little bit more off-piste to visit a particular building that they've seen in a book. A big kind of aim of the book for us was that we hoped that it didn't just appeal to architecture buffs. Like, the idea was that it would kind of appeal to anyone who's interested in culture more widely, which I guess goes back to this idea that you don't need to be trained or have this extensive knowledge of architecture to enjoy seeing a contemporary building now.
That was the rather wonderfully named Belle Place project editor of the book Destination Architecture, The Essential Guide to 1,000 Contemporary Buildings, published by Fiden. Next week,
probably 96.6% of everything that's done is either terrible or mediocre. So that leaves a very small amount. And I'm only interested in doing things that wind up being in that small amount.
We visit Canadian graphic designer turned artist Burton Kramer. Better known perhaps as the man behind the CBC logo, the prolific designer spoke to us from his Ontario home. Our question: what does a doyen of the industry with some six decades experience think of the developments shaping the graphic design industry today? Sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. Section D was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Daphne Karnesis, and edited by Sarah Miles. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.